Good morning, Paul Marx.
Jim, nice to be here. I was your guest a number of years ago on another station when there was a controversy of sorts about the fact that Mike Six did not go into his travel cage and go around the stadium. And we had a nice visit then. I'm honored to be here today.
Well, Mike Six missed a lot of games. He was pretty much a no-show the last few years, and now the word is that Mike Seven will not be retired or required to go to ball games. And that used to really intimidate the opposition, having the Tiger at the door of the visitor's locker room. Probably meant a touchdown or two for LSU. I remember the USC team sort of thought, what is this? Is that Tiger was roaring at them as they went out on the field. But the humane people think it's a bad idea, so apparently Mike will not be going to games any longer, and he has a nice cushy habitat that's worth several million dollars across the street. How were the surroundings for Mike the Third?
Mike had the same night house, as they call it, where he was fed, and his outside quarters were much smaller. He had a couple of logs and a couple other things to play with, but the habitat was much smaller. And
when you say much smaller, we're talking significantly smaller.
Correct. And it was equivalent to what I was accustomed to seeing at a zoo, and just didn't know any better. I think that was the original quarters from when Mike first was brought to LSU by Mike Chambers and others.
Well, when Mike the Third, as Tigers sometimes do, got cranky and didn't want to go to a ball game, it was your responsibility to get his backside across the street and go to the games. What did you do?
Well, we were instructed by his vets at that time, who did not have as much hands-on work with him as I've seen now from his very capable vets and vet students and so on. But we were instructed to feed him 6 days per week, and we simply did not feed him on the Friday before a home game. And he would usually go into the cage, the travel cage, which was a converted Miley two-horse trailer. But on one significant occasion, he simply would not go in. And
You were waving food at him?
Was that we had a little food in the cage, in the travel cage, which was our usual method. But he was spooked and wouldn't go in, and a large crowd gathered. And I went across the street. At that time, the athletic department had very humble quarters in the the east corner, I guess, on the north end, but just in the corner there. That's where the athletic director was located, the ticket office,
so on. Jim Corbett was the athletic director.
Correct.
You had to go get Corbett, and what did he say?
Right. I
get that Tiger to the game.
You're exactly right. And he not only said that, but he came across the street with me. He got campus security to back the crowd up. He, I'll never forget, he had a gold jacket, looked like some silk or something of that nature. He took it off and waved it at the Tiger.
Like a matador, right?
Like a matador, that's right, Jim. And lo and behold, the Tiger went in. He didn't say anything further to me. Was cordial thereafter. I never had to go to see him again about that. But I think he was in front of the cage for less than 5 minutes, certainly, and Mike went in the travel cage for him.
Now, when he would get to the game, were you with him the whole time?
Well, he was only at the game for a short time. We would enter the stadium on the east side and go through the area that included the visitors' locker room, and and were stationed there while the visitors came out for practice and went back in and came out for the game and so on. I'm sorry, we were gone by the time they came out for the game, but the cheerleaders would come over and get on top of the cage. They also did a great job of tapping on the cage, perhaps banging on it, to be candid, and that was done when the visitors were coming out for practice and for warm-up, and he would roar, and I can remember that occurring when some Crimson Tide players were there, and they jumped back significantly. We parked him in that fashion.
I would imagine so. And when you say roar, he was also moving around a little bit.
Correct.
Like he wanted to get out of that cage and come after those Crimson Tide players.
He paced around the travel cage, indeed.
Paul Marks is our guest. Many in this community of Baton Rouge know him as a prominent lawyer, but 1963 to 65, he was a caretaker for Mike III, LSU's Fighting Tiger mascot for 19 seasons, including the national championship season of 1958. He started with a bang. How did you get the gig? How did you become the caretaker?
Well, it had to be a student that lived in Baton Rouge or was committed to staying here for 2 years. I was able to get my predecessor to take care of him for a week or two during the first summer, and my successor to do the same thereafter. But it was a close friend. It's a long story that's irrelevant, but dates back to a gentleman who we were close to being on the Board of Supervisors, and just went down through the years.
You did this for three seasons?
No, two.
Two?
Correct. I had a very attractive parking pass in order to park in front of the animal science building. Of course, there was no vet school then to get his food, which was frozen. And, of course, we thawed it out, put vitamins on top. And some friends joked with me that the job didn't take very long because the time that I spent doing it was no more than what it would have taken to have parked down by the stadium and walked up the hill to where I was a student before law school.
Were you paid to do it?
Yeah, I got, as I recall, $40 a month, and that was for feeding him 6 days a week and for cleaning the cage. Reveille had a story about that. I think they focused on cleaning the cage, which really wasn't difficult. I did not go into the cage while Mike was there. believe me, I stood my distance.
Yeah, he was a ferocious animal. And on occasion, some people have actually let Mike the Tiger out. Some Tulane students did it in 1981, and he was roaming down Nicholson Drive, and fortunately nobody got hurt, but it took 13 men to lift him onto a back of a truck and get him back to his habitat. He was a big tiger, and all of them are big animals. You wouldn't want to tangle with Mike the Tiger.
No doubt about that. I was told that he was let out somehow or another once before my job came along, and I was told that one caretaker who was dismissed after this got the travel cage and opened it up with no mic inside and
oh my.
Drove through some student areas and asked them if
they'd seen Mike.
Correct. The students were not amused.
Well, you were living just off campus of Raymond Drive, if I remember the story correctly. That isn't that right?
Well, that's where my parents lived at that time. And
if I also remember correctly, it's been a while since we've talked about this. There was a night when Paul Marks had to take Mike the Tiger under the cloak of darkness and drive him to Raymond Drive, where he spent the night at your parents' house. Now, we're gonna hear more about this when we return, but am I on the right track? Do I have the story right?
Your memory, as usual, is very good.
Okay, all right. Well, this is a great story. What the heck's going on in our neighborhood tonight?
To the best of my knowledge, he did not create any disturbance.
Your parents knew about it?
Yeah, they weren't enthusiastic, God bless them, but my father was a double Tulane grad, and he thought it was amusing, but I'll leave it at that.
Well, on Raymond Drive, Mike the Tiger once spent the night. And Paul Marks, thanks for sharing your story.
My pleasure, Jim.
And let's keep it going. Talk to you soon. We're joined now by one of my former classmates at LSU, Carl Palmer, who was a cohort of mine at the campus radio station back in the day, and now he is a prominent actor of more than three decades. And this week he lost, as many did, one of the great icons of not only literature but acting, in Sam Shepard, who arrived in New York in 1963 at the age of 19 and then had an amazing career of duality on the screen and on the page. And Carl Palmer, you noted when you were reflecting on him in the last few days that he had an enormous impression on you. Why was Sam Shepard so important to you?
Well, Jim, good to see you. Because when I first got into theater, I was going to go to law school. I was at LSU, and I just kind of stumbled into it. Rather than go to took an acting class my last semester, I was thinking maybe I don't want to be a lawyer. I don't know. But I didn't know a damn thing about theater. And my girlfriend would sometimes drag me to see a musical at the Sanger or something like that. I was more into rock and roll and movies. But this playwright, you know, we had to read plays and stuff. I joined this thing, Fireside Book Club, and in order to, you know, see what's going on out there. And one of the plays that arrived was True West by Sam Shepard. It's a play about two brothers. One's like a desert rat. Lives out in the Mojave Desert, and the other guy is Austin, and he's trying to write a screenplay down in L.A. And the two brothers haven't seen each other for years. Anyway, the play, in many ways, the wild one kind of takes over the screenplay, and it's about the divided self, in a way. That thing about it being an American man sometimes that wants to settle down, and the other part just wants to hit the road. And so that just kind of grabbed me, and Sam Shepard, his father, was an alcoholic, and my mother was, and I didn't think about it much, talk about it much, but something in his plays, he was wrestling with that too, and they're just so, I just identified with it, recognized things going on in my own head, my own soul, you know, and I just knew he was playing music, you know, writing, you know, plays that I just identified with, you know, even though I'd never met the man.
Did you get close to meeting him?
Yeah, I was really lucky, really lucky. In 1992, the first movie ever made was The Pelican Brief. I was down here in Louisiana doing a play with Swine Palace, and The Pelican Brief was back in the day when they'd only shoot maybe one movie a year here, if that. And so I, you know, my friends Joe Crest and others, you know, fellow LSU actors, you know, said, yeah, you should go in. And, you know, they hooked me up with their agent. I went in, I booked it, lucky as could be. And my scene in the movie is Sam Shepard has the affair with Julia Roberts, or she's seeing him, or she's his law school professor, and boom, his car blows up with Sam inside of it. And right after, and she sees it, she faints. Right after, she gets in, you know, a couple of undercover guys, CIA guys, and I'm one of those guys, and I have these snakeskin cowboy boots on. And we ask him a couple of questions. So anyway, there we were on the set. And it was my first day ever on a movie set, and all of a sudden I walk in, and there's Sam Shepard. Like, it must have been the makeup thing. And I couldn't say anything to him, you know. I've always never been that starstruck or anything like that, but I couldn't, you know, walk up and say anything. I was just starstruck. I mean, it was just because, but not even starstruck, but Sam Shepard. He had these blue eyes and his dark hair, and he looked, you know, a Gary Cooper kind of thing, like you would imagine a movie star should look.
Yeah,
and
quite
caught my eye.
Quite a presence. Yeah, quite a presence.
Very much. Yeah, exactly. And so And then later, a couple of years ago, I worked on Bloodline, which he's amazing in. And unfortunately, he's mainly in the first season, and I was in the second season, so I didn't meet him then. But so that's, you know, on that movie, you know, it's Pelican Brief, I could walk up and say, hi, how you doing? It's Julia Roberts. But Sam Shepard, I couldn't do that.
Do you regret it?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Because he seems, you know, when you see stuff on him on, they describe him as a loner who didn't want to be alone. You know, he had that presence, that aura about him. At the same time, he, you know, looks like a very friendly guy. You know, I saw something last night from a YouTube thing when he was on The Moth, that radio series, and telling a story about from The Right Stuff, about him lending his horse to them. And, you know, he has a great sense of humor about himself and stuff. So, yeah, I think he was approachable. And I've had friends of mine that bumped into him. That he was. So, yeah.
Well, he was a Pulitzer Prize winning playwright and an actor with about 100 film credits. He was a busy man and a very talented man in everything he did. And there aren't many who can have this kind of success in two separate worlds, but he pulled it off.
Yeah, I think in part because of the camera, you know, he loves somebody with a presence. And he had that in spades. Great looking guy. And I was reading something where he just said he knew also that he could do less with more, you know, and just bring the camera to him, so to speak. And directors love that about him. And I think everybody, I mean, so many of us, before he became known as an actor, he was mainly a playwright. He was a playwright. And I think so many directors and stuff were, you know, probably like me, younger, who were just blown away by what he wrote. You know, it was so authentic and so American and true to life. And so, you know, they were like, "Yeah, let's you know." And he knew how to, you know, he knew how to act. Obviously, he's been around, you know, he'd been doing plays since he was a kid.
When Everybody's All American was filmed in Baton Rouge, his girlfriend of 27 years was Jessica Lange, who had the lead actress part in that film. So, he spent some time in Baton Rouge. Then they ultimately broke up, but he died July 27th, a week ago, 73 years old, Lou Gehrig's disease. In the last few years, Carl, he was not seen that much.
Yeah, and you know, and now that you think about it, on a Bloodline, you know, he's not doing much. He's mainly standing there, you know, sitting there. He's not really moving a lot, and maybe that was it. Although at one scene, he's in a boat, but yeah, it's so terribly tragic and ironic that he would go of ALS, because when you think of Sam Shepard, you think of a guy, you know, he hated to fly, and so he would drive wherever he was doing a movie. He would drive there, and he's written great things like essays and stuff like that about just driving across America. And it's just, anyway, so he couldn't move.
Well, we do have to roll.